Welcome to the Green Shoots podcast by Appleyard Lees, a conversation for those who own, manage or protect intellectual property.
Hi, I'm Ian Davis, a partner and patent attorney here at Appleyard Lees. I'm joined today by my fellow partner and patent attorney, Adam Tindall. In this episode of the podcast, we revisit episode 21, when we last talked about the working practices for in-house IP teams. We're going to discuss the current challenges that teams face in this situation when it comes to protecting innovation and look at how the priorities of in-house teams may have changed over the last 2 years. Adam, we're going to revisit what we talked about a couple of years ago. I suppose 2 years ago, we first looked at this during COVID times when we're all locked down at home and we're trying to work out exactly how things would work in the new normal and how long that new normal would last. I suppose we've got a better idea now of what the world looks like. Any idea initially on how you think things have changed in the world of IP in-house teams versus private practice?
I've been reflecting on not just in how things have changed in the past couple of years, but how maybe things have changed, you know, over a longer time frame. COVID sort of threw us into that was a catalyst for change, wasn't it? And but reflecting what things used to be like. I mean, so I used to work in-house at Rolls-Royce PLC years ago. That's where I first worked as engineer and then trained as a patent attorney. So, you know, you came into the office every day, you went to other sites in person, you know, if you had a meeting, which might have been in a different city, there was video conferencing for directors, but not for anyone else. And you picked up a lot of context on things about what was happening, you know, with the department, with the firm, you know, what was technically important without even really kind of realizing it. You know, and I think that's something which is very different now, isn't it? In terms of, you know, with people wanting to work from home a lot, and there are advantages to that, but then, you know, you miss out on all that stuff. You don't realize that you're assimilating while you're there.
And I guess that's a thing in common between being in private practice and in-house. I mean, like you, I started out in-house working for Nokia in the UK. That's where I qualified, then moved into private practice. And I think, again, there wasn't really an option back then. It was a long time ago now, but there wasn't really an option to work at home. It was very, very exceptional circumstances. And part of what you learned was just by walking around the office and catching up on things, and people would sort of come by you as a junior member of the team and say, can you do some research for me on this? And I think that's one of the things that we've found it hard to replicate in these sort of these hybrid working times, having people at home sometimes, in the office sometimes. But the tech that we use, Teams predominantly, does give you access to people. As long as they're working and they're sat at home, you can sort of knock on their shoulder, as it were, as if they were just sat next to you in the office. So that does help. I guess the focus this looking at sort of in-house teams versus private practice. I suppose from my time in-house, you were very much assigned to a particular project or you supported a particular business division and so on. So it's a kind of a sort of more proactive role, I think, than we have. I guess in private practice, we tend to be more often not reactive. The clients will ask us to do something and we'll do it. We don't have the same access to their inventors, you know, because they're driving us to do things. With some clients, you develop a kind of a pseudo in-house capability. I think one of the things that I really enjoyed about being in-house was having that close contact with the project team, seeing something come from the very germ of an idea through to pre-production, then production, then actually being shipped. And then maybe seeing the IP problems that came on the back of that. There might be somebody who would threaten you with infringement. You might become aware of competitors, and you were much more involved in that sort of the commercial process. Whereas in private practice here, you know, we're driven by, we don't know about that stuff unless the client tells us oftentimes. And I think that's a real shift in focus when you move into private practice from in-house. Did you find that a bit of maybe a culture shock in having to deal with multiple different clients rather than just one?
The way the team was organized at the time was many of us would have different technical areas that we were looking after. But yes, you're right. There is the balance of dealing with lots of people that all need something doing, you know, right now was a bit of a culture shock. And they're all important. They do all need doing right now, and you need to find a way to do that. Mm. I mean, I think with, you know, the joy of being in-house for me at least was that, yes, you are that much closer to the technology, and it's for me, who is, you know, an engineer first and lawyer second. Well, I guess, you know, I guess all patent attorneys are scientist or engineer first, and then lawyer second, because that's the order that you have to do it when you're choosing your career, isn't it? But the days I enjoy most now are when I'm kind of back in that mode of walking around a factory, looking at equipment, and you know, actually sat down talking to the people about the real things that they're making.
We've been on a trip together to see a client and seen some very impressive tech. And it does take you back to those days of thinking, well, I could just leave my desk at any point when I was in-house and go and look at this stuff. Now you've got to be specifically invited to go and see it. And it is, you know, maybe it's just the variation thing. It's nice to get away and do something a bit different. But there is something about meeting the engineers and really sort of picking up on their enthusiasm of something fantastic. And often you're the first person that I've spoken to about their invention who hasn't been part of the team that are currently working on it, because they're keeping it secret as they're supposed to. So sitting down and talking to them about something that is really taken up a large part of their lives for the last few months, potentially, it's a great privilege, really, to be the first person to learn of these things.
Well, that's it, exactly. It gives you a much greater context and understanding about what the invention is. Now, we have to distill out these things, don't we, and put them onto paper and get over that idea to examiners. And it's hard to do that in isolation. There was a client a while ago where they, you know, what they were doing in itself arguably wasn't clever until you appreciated that it was a very big thing that they were making, and hence all the technical issues that kind of revolve around handling something which is just very big. But you had no sense of that just looking at this little, you know, on a drawing on a piece of paper. It could be an inch across or it could be a mile across. There was no kind of sense of that sort of context. But
that's definitely a difference, isn't it, in these sort of these hybrid working times, because in the past there was no alternative but to go and see the clients. You know, you might get something, an email to describe it, but you know, I guess most of the time you'd go and see a client, have that in-person meeting, go and look at the tech. But now I think people have got so used to sharing things electronically that it's almost the default option is not to meet. And sometimes you really do need to do that. And that does make a big difference. I wonder whether the hybrid working thing has actually made us too remote sometimes from clients. And I think it suits everyone to be at home some of the time. There's no commuting, all that stuff. But you miss out on that context sometimes, which can be really important.
On the other hand, I mean, when I was in the house, and I'm reflecting on how I used to work with the external firms which we used, I think we did treat them pretty much as, you know, we'd send someone an invention disclosure form and we'd expect a patent application back from it. We didn't. I think things have changed and improved a lot now, you know, and seeing it from the other side in terms of, well, actually, a meeting with the inventor would be great. And, you know, and now we can share these things on the screen and we can talk through it properly. And everybody is very savvy with that now. So it's, although, you know, the in-person meets are maybe not as often as they used to be, but the access to, you know, the core people is much easier now. And it does, you know, from working in private practice, working with industry, it's, you know, the tools we have now are brilliant in terms of, you know, opening up that access wherever that person is, you know, whether they're working at home or whether they're in the office, you know, and they're kind of dedicated to that process at that time to take you through it. So yeah, how did you used to work with the external counsel?
Well, yeah, excellent. We didn't use too many, actually. We tend to do most of it in-house in those days. There were some cases we outsourced, but it was just ramping up at the time that I left, actually. So it wasn't a huge part of our role to work with external counsel. It tended to be there were occasions where someone had perhaps left our department and gone to private practice and they had a particular expertise and they managed to take some cases with them, which was, you know, great for my employer because they were able to maintain that expertise, right, at additional cost maybe, and good for the departing attorney to turn up a new job and say, yeah, I bought some work in from Nokia, which was, you know, quite a feather in their cap, really. So that was the extent of it, really. It wasn't a big part of what we did. But I was just intrigued about, you know, working with external agents, because obviously being on the other side of the fence now, we see how we interact with our bigger clients, and particularly clients that have their own in-house patent teams. You know, that's where the interface is really, you know, it should be the smoothest in some ways, and often it is, because you're dealing with other attorneys. They know the pressures. They know what's involved. Sometimes when you're dealing with it's called a lay client, that they don't always understand the processes we have to go through. But when you're dealing with an in-house team of other patent attorneys, you know, that's when there's a real buzz about getting that work together, because they know exactly what's involved, and often they're outsourcing because they're too busy. You know, there's other resourcing issues or there's particular expertise they can call on. And I find that more gratifying in some ways, I suppose, because, you know, that they could go anywhere and they've chosen to come to us. And that's often the result of many years of experience, or, you know, we've built up quite a lot of close relationships with clients like that. And it's nice to think they'll pick up the phone and say, I've got this really urgent case. Can you take it on, please? Because I know you'll do a good job.
I think it's interesting, reflecting on how things were when I worked in-house, and there was, you know, one would see the different models in other firms, and things would change while in the department. You know, there'd be, the idea that the models would change from, well, we should have as many people as possible to, well, you know, actually maybe it's better to have fewer people and outsource more, and each company would do it differently, and each company still does do it differently. We still haven't, it doesn't seem to have distilled out to a, yes, this is a perfect solution for all. And I'm really surprised at how some really quite big companies have, you know, tiny IP teams, and maybe sometimes only like two or three people who are, you know, really heavily reliant on the external resource that they adapt around them. And then, you know, and then the other extreme is other companies that have, you know, IP departments, which, you know, are larger than, you know, quite a lot of patent attorney firms, you know, and they've gone entirely the other way. And it's, you know, that they, for the smaller teams, that's quite a job, I think, to not just manage all the issues that you're dealing with in-house, being one of just a couple of points of contact, but also managing those interfaces with the people that you're outsourcing work to, and kind of, you know, establishing that external team effectively, even though they're people working for a different company and they're, you know, they're charging you money for what they do, just kind of treating them as kind of part of the family, which, and it's nice when companies want to do that with us as well. I think that really is very satisfying. You feel trusted and you feel like part of the gang, don't you?
No, absolutely. I think that's one of the things that we try and, you know, make clear to clients. And I think it's one of the reasons that people do pick us, perhaps over other firms, is that we do have that kind of in-house mentality sometimes, you know, where it's appropriate with the clients. If they want us to be part of their in-house team and to work as if we are employed by them rather than just retained as an external advisor, then I think we can add a lot more to the process than if we are just sort of dipping in and out. So that we can all think of examples, I guess, of clients where we do that. And that is very, very gratifying. I mean, there's a couple of my clients where I do have very close relationships with the inventors, and I will speak to them directly. It's not going through the IP organizer necessarily. You know, if I need to have a technical answer, a question answered, I can pick up the call and there we go. It's fantastic. And I think sometimes when you're too removed from the client, you don't have that kind of freedom to engage direct with the inventors. And sometimes a 5-minute call can save an awful lot of headbanging and and grief, both at the time and further down the line as well. Is it worth looking at just experience of both of us in-house? I mean, it's a little while ago, especially for me now, but I think in terms of the spread of work, I think it's interesting to look at how things are different now in private practice compared to being in-house. So I mentioned before the idea of being attached to a project and sort of mirroring them and coaching them through the process and trying to harvest inventions from them compared to being in-house. And that's, I suppose, one of the obvious differences. But I was thinking in terms of the actual spread of work of what you're doing in-house. I know for a lot of my in-house clients, they will be looking at, if they're in a university setting, for instance, they might be looking at impact statements. They might be looking at grant applications. They might be looking at contract negotiations with an incoming academic and so on. And it's very, very different to what you and I now do, you know, day to day in terms of writing patent applications, prosecuting them, getting them granted and so on. I think maybe as the firm got bigger as well, I mean, I've been here for 20 plus years now. And the number, I know it's hard to believe it, but the number of people that we've got in the electronics team is I don't know, 4 or 5 times what it was when I joined. And, you know, the specialization within that team has now got, you know, enormously sort of granular. There are people who do very, very high-end sort of crypto type things, blockchain, cryptography, telecoms, you name it, AI. There's all those specialties within what would previously be regarded as, oh, you do electronics, you can handle this power station as well as this laptop computer. And I think now there probably are people who can do that. And I think that's very doable within the team. But when you do need that level of expertise, being a firm of the size that we are now, we can find somebody who's got the absolute spot on technical expertise to take on a particular task. I know our colleagues who work in sort of biotech and chemistry is perhaps even more specialized. You know, there are different elements of those technical specialties that are very, very narrow, and finding somebody who can actually get a handle on the tech is really difficult. But we're of a size now where we can do that.
I think that is one of the most interesting developments, and it's only in the past couple of years where clients used to be specialize in a particular type of product. You would know they were a mechanical client, you would know they were a chemical client, mm. or they were, and now you know, it's changed that they're all tech clients, insofar as there's always a software angle to what they're doing. There's you know, and whether it's a control, whether it's you know, marketing, a user interface, or you know, how to work with AI to develop or products that they're selling. And it's, and that's a challenge for us, isn't it, in terms of, you know, it's no longer okay, there's a one person or two people who help serve as this client. You do actually have to reach out to your colleagues and other teams and say, well, you know, for if you're going to, if you want AI, we do have people who do that, but you know, it's going to, you know, you're going to have to talk to my mate.
I suppose the classic area is like medical devices and pharma things in general, because, you know, I've got a client who they started out as they made some pharmaceutical preparation, and then they wanted to make a device that detected some change in that. So my colleague who did the pharma bit of it says, right, can you help out with this, the design of this electronic part? And it was a client that I would never would have considered working for or even coming close to in the past. But now those sort of multidisciplinary teams are becoming more and more common. I know that several people here work with people in very, very diverse technical areas where, you know, maybe 10, even 15 years ago, you'd think there'd be no crossover at all. You know, like you say, they're a pure chemical client. Why would we need AI? Well, they're looking at improving their manufacturing process. They're looking at, you know, purifying the product, and that's something we can do to help. So it's becoming much more sort of important, I think, to have a feel of different technical areas than your own. It's quite easy to be siloed, isn't it? But to have at least an understanding, maybe not in-depth understanding, but enough of an understanding to know that, oh, hang on, there's an alarm bell ringing that we should be considering X when we're looking at this invention, is something that we all need to be thinking about a lot more.
I think, yeah, I mean, I guess that was always the case to some extent, wasn't it? That it's a, you know, if you ask a mechanical engineer what a, you know, what the invention is, they'll probably see it from the point of view of all its engineering aspects. And, you know, you've always had to think, well, you know, is there something to do with materials here? Or is there something to do with process control? Or is there something to do with, you know, manufacturing? But yes, we have to keep learning, don't we, in terms of what are the other things we should be thinking about here, you know, and what not to dismiss in the same, because maybe clients would dismiss, well, you know, it's an AI algorithm. There's nothing patentable there. And it's like, well, you know, let's talk about that.
We touched briefly there on the idea of AI and how that features from a drafting patent applications, understanding inventions in that area, but in the patent world in general, there is a talk of using AI to help prepare patent applications in the first place. It's something that's a bit of a Wild West territory as far as we're concerned. We're not blind to the fact that AI can help us. There are all sorts of practical and legal issues about using it, not least of which is if you this is a warning to anyone who happens to be listening to this, that don't type the details of your invention into Google or ChatGPT or something in the hope that it'll come back with a patent application for you, because by typing that in, you're potentially disclosing your invention, or you're at least losing control of it. It's no longer within your power to say that this is my invention, it's confidential. So we certainly don't do anything like that. But there are certain standalone, ring-fenced, localized AI servers which will help us to develop patent specifications. I know a couple of colleagues are looking into this at the moment with a view to saying, well, what can they do for us? What's all the fuss about? We're certainly not using it as a means of producing professional output at the moment. So don't worry, we're not replacing any of the attorneys here with AI. But what can it do? Can it help us just label the figures? Can it help us produce bits of the specification? Can it prepare description of the prior art? There are things that can be done, and we're trying to work out whether that will actually help us in the long run. And if it can, it might make the whole process more efficient, cheaper, better, but it's a big question mark at the moment.
It's an extra burden for clients as well, isn't it, in terms of, you know, not only are they controlling their data in-house, you know, Now, before there's an expectation that if you send material out to your private practice firm, which is serving you, then, well, of course it's confidential, you know. But then there's, like you say, there's this risk of, hang on, maybe the tool that somebody is using might count as a disclosure in the future. I've seen that in like requests from different clients, you know, asking very specific questions about, you know, do we use AI tools or that we shouldn't use AI tools. You know, and other clients being interested in us using AI tools, you know, because any cost savings that there are, you know, that we should pass those on to them, you know, it's quite difficult to balance that all those expectations. Again, when we don't yet know how it's going to pan out in terms of how useful those tools are, and I mean, it's like with when I've been playing with it just for personal use, or, you know, okay, you might ask it a legal, might ask these things a legal question. It always seems to fall back to, well, does that answer feel about right? Hang on, no, I'm not sure it does. And that which you know, it is based on your own experience that you've developed over years, isn't it? So, I'm kind of excited that the AI might, you know, complement the profession rather than being a challenge to it, and that it can, you know, maybe help us do a better job as opposed to replacing
us. I think we're certainly not being Luddites about it, are we? I think it's the. I wonder whether we're going to get on the road of here's a mass-produced AI patent application versus a handcrafted, artisan, organic, human expertise patent application, which will be much more expensive. But will it be better? I mean, I thought in the short term, at least, the human version will always be better. You know, fast forward 10, 15, 20 years, jury's out. Who knows?
I can't see how it could replace all the human interactions, you know, in terms of let's talk about what the invention is, let's talk about what's important, what are the key features, what are the starting point. It must surely only ever be, you know, a kind of like a spruced up word processor that, you know, that helps you, you know, gives you a first draft or something. But maybe I'll be wrong. One sees stuff online and people rave about it and say that it's really good. But I've never actually used one to try drafting myself. For all the conservative reasons that we spoke about, but
we have to be careful about these things. So hence the testing it out and so on. But I do wonder, I'm not aware of any of our clients with, you know, in-house teams particularly, who are looking at this from their own perspective, whether they're using it either to prepare patent applications or even perhaps to, you know, help them invent. There are systems I know that will help with invention, not just from the point of view of filing patent applications, but looking at different ideas to flesh out inventions. Have you come across anything like that? It's maybe people don't shout about it if they're using it. I don't know.
No, not at all. No, all I'm still seeing is, you know, there's still, you know, thankfully, still the same, you know, creative people doing interesting things.
Okay, well, hopefully you found some of that useful and interesting at least. So thanks to Adam for joining us on this little journey. I'll see you again soon.
As always, Ian, a pleasure to chat through these things with you.
Cheers, everyone. Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening to the Green Shoots podcast by Appleyard Leeds. If you have a question or issue you would like our IP specialist to discuss on the podcast, then tweet us at appleyardleeds or email us at ip@appleyardleeds.com.